Accession number 26729, Reel 3.
Bob Cherry, Reel 3. You were talking about your time transporting POWs and troops from various parts of the...
Middle Far East.
Middle Far East, yes.
Yes, far Singapore. And it was in Transport Command we learned the art of bartering, when we first started, the carpets were the thing, bring back carpets. And then some of the chaps got onto drugs as well, unfortunately.
Really? What sorts of drugs?
Oh, the hard stuff. So what used to happen is that they used to go into a certain shop in Karachi and said and gave them the number of the aircraft and when they would be leaving Karachi, and then go out and then take off and land in Egypt and walk into a shop and say, I've just landed from so and so, and they never actually saw the drugs, but they were well paid for it.
So people used to put it on their aircraft and unload it at the other end?
Yeah, nobody. I mean, the crew never saw it. They didn't even know where it was on board the aircraft.
And what are we talking about? Heroin?
Well, I should imagine heroin and cocaine. I mean, it was the heart stuff. There's no doubts about that. And the only time that anything happened was one of the aircraft was flying into Cairo. And the air traffic control called them up and said that the police would be waiting for them when they landed. And they realised that if they were caught with that, they'd had it. And they scurried around the aircraft, found where the dope was, and dumped it in the Mediterranean.
And how commonplace was that, transporting drugs?
How
commonplace was that?
I don't know. As far as I know, it wasn't commonplace. There were just one or two rogues that did it. And it used to pull me to think they could do such a thing as that, but that's me.
And were you not subject to customs when you came back?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, the customs. But then again, on that one, you... You used your common sense. I mean, for example, Badger's birthday coming up. I'd go and see the customs bloke before I set off. I said, oh, by the way, I'd like to bring a wristwatch or what have you back for Betty. It'll be a birthday when we get back. Okay. Yeah, okay, Bob, if I'm not on duty, then tell so-and-so you've seen me. And it was all right. Now, I told the crew about this one, and the first trip we did, we came back and we went in to see the customs, and the customs went straight to the wireless operator and said, open up your suitcase. And he was the only one that had broken the law. And so he got a good old doing over, and I threatened him that if he ever did that again, he'd be kicked out of the crew. And they didn't seem to like that somehow. And so that was it. So we didn't have any more trouble, except before that, when we came... Oh, that was when we were in the Azores, was it? When we came back from the Azores and landed at St. David's, my navigator said, I've got some stuff on board, Bob. I said, what do you mean you've got some stuff on board? Well, he says, I've got quite a few bottles, crates of champagne and wine and whatnot. I said, what in heaven's name did you do that for? I said, oh, it's a good trade. And so when we landed, I said, right, got all this stuff and put it onto the coach and drove to the mess and said, put this in the cellar, please. And then the navigator was called back by air traffic control. The customs went to see them. They hadn't arrived when we landed. And he came back with a grin all over his face. I said, what's the matter, Freddie? Oh, he said, nothing. He said, they just seemed to think I'd put one bottle down too many on my customs declaration form. Would I cross it out? There's no one did cross it. Well, it was, you know. But that was it. So, where are we now?
1946. I think you said you finished transporting troops and POWs.
When did the airlift start? 1948, wasn't it? So we were the transporting of POWs didn't take too long, quite obviously, and then from then on, we're flying out doing regular routine work of taking new troops and new airmen out to the Middle and Far East, and then bring the Timex Fires ones back, and that went on until 1948. I think it was when the Berlin Airlift started.
Can you tell me about your role in that?
what happened was one Sunday afternoon we were called in by the CO to say that we were going to be flying out to Germany the next day to take part in an airlift, and at which time it was top secret, or at least I was under the impression it was top secret. But about 12 months before that, we'd done what was called Operation Long Stop. And that was an exercise to see how a force of transport aircraft could land at an airfield, dispose of its cargo, fly back again, reload and do it again. Now, nobody realised that that was a precursor or the pre-runner to the Berlin Airlift. So when we were briefed on that one, I went to see the CEO and said, "Excuse me, sir, can I be excused about going out tomorrow?" "Why?" I says, "Well, my second girl's being christened on Sunday." "All right. On your way." So I joined them about 10 days later. And when we first started on the airlift, Wunstorf was a comparatively small airfield. But I think it had only got one runway. And by the time it finished the Berlin airlift, it had developed a big heart standing which could hold up anything up to 100 aircraft. And when we first started flying into Berlin, there was no regulations. You just flew in at what height you wanted. Gatow. And then came home again. So aircraft were doing that all the time.
So you were in at the beginning of the airlift. Which would have been about June 1948, I think.
Yep. July. June. Around about June, July. Yeah, and...
What sort of goods were you flying into Berlin?
All sorts.
And what sort of planes were you flying?
Yorks then. And they were flying in coal, flour. When we first started, we were flying in electric transformers, which were far exceeded the load of the York. But fortunately, nobody pranged using one of those, or with those on board. And then it was all sorts of goods. Now, at Christmas, I took a York into Berlin, and it was loaded with all the goodies imaginable, all for the army headquarters, so the Germans didn't get anything on that trip at all. But it was basically coal and flour and things like that, of which were loaded by the Germans and offloaded by the Germans. After a short time...
Can we just go into a bit more detail? You said initially the air traffic control of that area was a bit chaotic.
Yeah. There was no direction at all. I mean, you just took off. You flew to Gatow, you offloaded, you took off, you landed at Wunstorf, reloaded, back to Gatow. As I say, with aircraft going both ways. And I mean, why we never had a mid-air collision, I'll never know, but we didn't. And then along came the a bit of organisation, because by that time the Americans were flying into...
Tegel?
No, the other one, Tempelhof. And so somebody devised a system whereby we would stick rigidly to rules. And so when it was organised, we flew from Bunnersdorf north to an RAF base there, which was a turning point, then down the corridor to Berlin, to a pinpoint spot there, and then we turned in and landed at Gatow.
Which corridor were you using?
We were using the what I would call the northern corridor. Forget the name of the darned airfield. We landed there one night. We flew northeast up and towards Hamburg, and then we had this corridor down from Hamburg down to Berlin. Then on the way back, it was straight from Berlin back to Gatow. Now the Americans came from the south, and they came up their corridor, and then they turned off at Tempelhof. Now later on, the Tegel was built. And it was built in a matter of weeks, which was very useful to our side of the house, which meant we could put more aircraft in, using both Gatow and Tegel. And it was going like steam. What had happened? We'd have a briefing on the weather, basically, and they would tell us what the weather was like at Berlin. Well, if the weather was a bit on the dove side, we'd take off at 5 minute intervals. If the weather was good, it was 3 minute intervals. Well, you could almost guarantee 9 times out of 10 when you got to Berlin, it was just the reverse. So if we're at 5 minute intervals and the weather was good, we'd call up the control and say, can we expedite? So instead of being 5 minutes apart, by the time we got to landing, we're just going in one after the other. And then, of course, the other times when we're 3 minutes and the weather was bad, we still stuck to that. But at that time, we were going in under GCA, Ground Controlled Approach. And we were going in there one day, and suddenly the GCA controller said, steer 180 degrees. I think, say 180 degrees. I said, that's wrong, that's 180 degrees out. We're going in, that's it, we were going in on 090. And he said he gave us 270, which was going back from the way we came. So I said to the navigator, ignore that, we'll go in under SVA, which is one of the things on the aircraft, and we landed on that one. But that was the only mistake I ever came across, and the chappie, when the report went in, still said he couldn't remember saying it.
So you're flying in at these sort of quite tight intervals.
Yeah.
What would happen if... for some reason, you didn't manage a successful landing, or you missed your slot, or
then you went back. No, circling around. You just kept going. There was one night when we were coming back to Bunnersdorf, and it turned out to be freezing rain, and we were just going into approach, and we hit the deck rather hard. And so it was a question of throttles wide open, wheels up, and then we went up to the relief airfield and stayed there overnight. And that was the sort of thing that happened. But the one guiding principle was, if you missed your slot, you carried on.
And when you were returning, did you return along the same corridor or a different...
No, you came
through the central corridor?
No, you kept the same altitude. I forget what the thing was. I have a sneaky feeling that we flew in at 3,500 feet on the Yorks. The Dakotas went in at 2,500. And I have a sneaky feeling the other aircraft, civilian aircraft, went in at 1,500. But that I wouldn't be sure of. But there was sufficient separation between the different aircraft to make it safe.
So you'd return along the same corridor?
But we'd all return along the same corridor.
At your own altitude?
Yeah.
So how was the progression of aircraft organised? Did you have Dakotas and Yorks flying at the same time at different altitudes, or did you...
No, we went in slots. They were given us a slot and they took off. And then at the same sensible time, we took off behind them. And then the civilians, I think the civilians went in independently.
How was the airfield organised? Because you had civilian aircraft as well as RAF aircraft,
yeah,
using Wunderstorff.
Well, you had an operations room. I mean, the civilians had their own ground crew and everything, but they still had to go through the same briefing that we did. So you got this ops room where you reported in for duty. You were given what time to take off you had, what the interval would be, and then you'd do, I think it was 2 trips at a time.
Who was in charge of that operations room? Was it RAF?
Yeah, a wing commander in the RAF. As it was, I mean, each airfield had its own operations room. Same with the Americans, they had their ops room as well. But it was all coordinated by a central control. And it worked like a dream.
Was there any friction between RAF and civilian crews?
No. No, the only friction, if you could call it that, was the Americans and themselves, because the Americans had got making a bit of a joke out of it, which was okay. And where we used to go into Berlin, there was the Frohnau beacon, and then from there we turned into Gatow, and the Americans would come up with some ditty. Oh, here comes a Yank with a blackened soul, bound for Gatow with a load of coal. So we boys would then think of something up to say the same. And that's the only rivalry there was. Otherwise, it was, as far as I know, it was complete compatibility.
And at Berlin, at Gatow, did you... what was the turnaround like? Did you actually disembark from the aircraft, or did you...
You just had time to disembark, have a cup of coffee, and then get aboard again. Because as soon as you landed and got into your parking spot, the Germans were there with the heavy lorries and the crews, offloading as fast as possible. And the so it was slick. You can't say anything else, but it really was slick.
And were the Americans organising the air traffic control operations at the Berlin end, at Gatow, or was it the...
Oh, they were at Tempelhof.
The RAF were doing Gatow.
The RAF were doing Gatow, the Americans were doing Tempelhof, but there's a central control which controlled the whole of the Air Force, the whole of the Air Forces and civilian aircraft.
Did you ever transport anything back from Berlin?
Oh yeah, we sometimes brought passengers back, but very, very few goods. And if the passengers came back, they were sitting on the floor. I mean, there were no seats on board. But that was all.
Were they civilians or?
Yeah, possibly school children.
And what would be the purpose of bringing school children out?
Because the parents wanted them out, to get them into in Germany, where they possibly had relatives, where the children could settle down and then go to school there, in Western Germany.
Did you actually live on the base?
Yes.
What sort of accommodation did you have?
We had very good accommodation. I mean, it was the ex-Luftwaffe quarters, and they lived like kings, believe you me. And so we had, we had very good rooms, complete with showers, the lot. And one of the interesting things was, as we ran short of pilots, I suddenly had... a lieutenant, Peter Downright, joined me, an ex-paratrooper, an ex-glider pilot. And he was in the mob that took Wunderstorff from the Germans. So he took me all through it and showed me where it came in and what to where, then showed me the bullet holes that were made and all the rest of it. And an interesting fact is that after he left us, after the airlift, and went back into the army again, he finished up, I think, as a Knight of the Realm as a Major General.
So the accommodation was good.
Yep.
Did you have your own room, or?
We're a shared room of two. And the mess, of course, was run by the in typical German style. We had German waitresses, and I mean, we were treated extremely well indeed.
What about the civilian population, the German civilian population? Did you have much to do with them?
Not too much to do with them at all, because we were too busy. If we went out at all on recreation, we used to go into Hanover and go to the CCG place, where the civilian government, who again lived like fighting cocks, and so we used to have good nights out with them.
Did you get any leave during that time?
Yeah, yes, I got the occasional leave. In fact, the Christmas of that year, I was at home. Do you want to go to the toilet?
No.
Oh. So the leave was regular, and I've tried to remember what we did. I think we had to, whilst we were working, it was 5 days on and 5 days off. And the 5 days off, sometimes we go to one of the rest centres in the Harz Mountains, which was a nice relief for us. We worked hard, but we weren't overworked.
How many runs into Berlin would you do per day?
I think it was two. It might have been four. I'd think. Well, I did over 400 trips into Berlin. But one of the chaps, a Canadian, he did over 600.
And how many aircraft did the RAF have running out of Wilmersdorf?
I'd have to look that up.
Did you ever have any problems with Russian aircraft or Russian activities in the air corridor?
No, I didn't. They told me they were flogging up down the corridor, and one or two of the chaps did see them, but I didn't see one at all. It never bothered me. So, again, a little uneventful in that sense.
Any particular memories? Any kind of hairy incidents or things that stick out?
The only hairy incident was making that hard landing at Wunstorf and then flogging straight off to the relief landing field. The squadron only had one fatality. And that was on takeoff, and we don't know what happened, but it suddenly went in. And the interesting thing was, the captain of that aircraft was only teetotal in the squadron. All the drunken lot stayed alive. I did go out to the aircraft once, and it was loaded with flour. And I said, "This is wrong." And they said, "What's wrong?" I said, "The load's been put in backwards." They said, "No, it's not. It's to change it." So they changed it, got it right. So we're all right. I mean, if we'd have taken off as it was, we wouldn't have. We'd have gone in. But I mean, they're the only things. There was one which didn't affect me, but it affected one of the crews on the squadron. They took off from Gatow one night, and the next thing was the engineer woke up and said, "Skipper, Wunstorf's ahead, wheels down, flaps down," and all the crew had fallen to sleep, and the aircraft just stayed straight and level all the way until, as I say, the engineer woke up just in time.
Where was that? Because everyone was just...
I think it was called drinking. When we first started, we did keep the officers' mess bar open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So when we landed and had our post-operation meal, which was always the egg and bacon, then we used to hive off to the mess to relax before going to bed.
What, was drinking a problem?
Oh, not a problem, but just enjoyed it. You know, it's that was one of the rare occasions where that happened. But as I say, the only accident we had, the captain was teetotal.
And were there any rules about drinking prior to flying?
No, not in those days. No, I mean, we had the Transport Command air flying instructions, but that was all, and I can't ever remember drink being mentioned in it.
Any other memories that stick out?
No, I wouldn't have thought so.
Were you aware of the significance of what you were involved in at the time?
No, not really. Not personally. It was only later, when I got interested and started reading up all about it, that I found the real reason behind it. I mean, you know what happened, possibly, that the Germans, the Russians closed the borders, and which started the airlift. But the airlift started only because one air commodore of the RAF in Berlin said that it could be done. The Americans were dead against it. They were all for sending in the tanks and everything else that went with it. But this air commodore managed to convince the CNC of the American forces we could do it by air. And that's how it came about. The Americans have listened to us.
So you only became aware of it afterwards, how important it was? To
absolutely,
Berlin.
Operational.
I mean,
I don't suppose there's any real need to know. You'd got a job of work to do, so you got on with it. You were too busy to bother about the side effects.
Were you ever aware of any politicians that came to visit?
Yes, we had the... I think it was... Ernest Bevin came to see us at Lynham. I never met any politician at either Wunstorf or Gatow. But at Lynham, when he came down, he was greeted quite riotously behind the scenes. He wasn't very popular.
Do you remember, did he speak to...
He didn't speak to us. He spoke to somebody, some of the people. Michael, we were running a few of the squadron there. We're only back for a short time. I'm picking up another aircraft, because after a certain time, the servicing couldn't be done in Germany. He'd had to come back for majors. And so that's when we used to come back with absolute defected aircraft, with most of the instruments missing, because they'd been cannibalised to keep the aircraft going on the airlift.
Bob Cherry, Reel 4. After the airlift,